Hello and welcome to another episode of Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast, where we interview guests about their life through the food and drink that has defined it. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts. Alyssa Timoshkina is a chef, supper club hostess extraordinaire, and film and food writer. Her first cookbook, Salt and Thyme, a personal exploration of Siberian food, was published earlier this month. Alyssa, welcome to Table Talk.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Alyssa, you grew up in Siberia and your mother was of Jewish Ukrainian heritage and your father came from Russia's Far East. What was food like when you were growing up?
It's quite a fascinating place, really, because it's such an interesting melting pot of different cultures. So the part of Siberia where I'm from, it borders Kazakhstan. So we had a lot of Central Asian influences as well. And obviously, living in the Soviet Union, because I was born in the early 80s, so living in the Soviet days, there was so much migration within the country. I always remember the markets, which were so full of people from all over the former Soviet Union, and you could get access to Georgian food as well as Soviet Korean food. So to me, Siberia really kind of represents that idea of a melting pot in terms of the culinary influences.
And was that something that was reflected in the food you ate at home with your family?
Yes, definitely. It's interesting. I mean, growing up, you know, I personally wasn't really very aware of exactly what am I eating. You just kind of eat what you're given and think that's everyone.
You're a child.
Exactly. You think everyone eats that and that's normal. But recently when I was already working on the book, I was just kind of talking to other Russians or people from the former Soviet Union thinking, you know, kind of sharing recipes, and lots of people said, oh, like soy sauce, we never had any. And obviously I've realized that because my dad was from the Far East and the town that he comes from was literally on the border with China. So soy sauce was a completely standard thing in that part of Soviet Union, whereas, you know, it was unheard of in the more kind of Western or northern part, you know. So we got lots of soy sauce from my gran from the Far East, and a very traditional Siberian dish, pelmeni, the meat dumplings, which are traditionally eaten with sour cream. We would always add soy sauce to that as well, because I just, like, my dad just loves soy sauce, so he would always like have it with pelmeni, which nowadays it's quite a common thing to do, but back in the 80s that was not standard at all.
I suppose when people think about Siberia, they imagine it to be very cold and snowy.
Yeah,
I mean, is it? And also, what does that mean for kind of fresh food? And is it easy to get fresh produce?
It is very cold, yes. But the snow is such a beautiful phenomenon. I just love it, and I really miss it living here now. And obviously, the snow. I almost feel like using inverted commas when I say the snow that falls Make out snow. Here. Yeah, not so sure about that. This kind of climate, it's quite extreme. So the temperature used to go to minus 40 and then in the summer go up to kind of plus 30. So it's, you know, huge range. So in the summer, lots of people have their own summer houses where they grow their own produce or like small plots of lands. And the summer produce is quite abundant. So you get lots of fresh herbs, lots of, you know, radishes, cucumbers, tomatoes, all kind of standard stuff. And then foraging for mushrooms in kind of early autumn. But in winter, obviously, because the temperatures are so low, there's literally nothing that's produced. I mean, these days there's so much imported food that doesn't really affect, you know, the way the diet changes at all. But back in the 80s, it would change drastically. And that's where the whole kind of art of fermentation and kind of the culture of fermentation comes in, where you would have to ferment. Otherwise, you would have a lot less to eat in winter. And obviously, the winter lasts kind of all the way into kind of mid-spring. So I remember always kind of going foraging for mushrooms and then pickling them so they can be eaten with, you know, like mashed potatoes or something like that in winter, and obviously krauts and cucumbers and tomatoes. So the whole kind of family tradition of fermenting is very much connected to the climate and the seasons, which I think is quite a beautiful way to eat, really.
And what were mealtimes like? Did you have big family dinners or sort of smaller during the winter? Does everyone just stay at their own house?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing was that we shared, to begin with, we shared our flat with my grandparents. So the kind of that kind of sense of a bigger family and a bigger family meal was definitely there. Normally, I mean, it does not even depending on the weather. I mean, in general, there weren't really that many outings to go out to eat. You know, people didn't go to restaurants or canteens. People did eat at home. So the tradition of eating at home and gathering around the table with family or friends was a completely standard thing to do. And I also lived with my great-grandmother, who was a really big influence on me, and she was an amazing cook. She actually worked as a cook, so she cooked for a living. So she did lots of baking and kind of made hearty borscht, and yeah, you kind of think of mashed potatoes and kind of nice pickles and ferments as kind of a very traditional, simple, traditional kind of Russian meal that pretty much every family had.
We'll come to this later on, but you've obviously ended up doing a lot of hosting and supper clubs. Yeah. Is that something that's in your blood? Was there hosting going on in your family home?
My mum, yeah, she's a big hostess. She's a big party person. Even back in the 80s when we finally got our own apartment, and my mum was only in her early 20s when I was born, so she was, you know, super young and obviously wanted to socialize lots. And so the teeny tiny kitchen that we had in our one, it's not even one bedroom, it's like a studio kind of one room apartment that we had, there were always people in the kitchen, and, you know, the kitchen was the real kind of socializing space, and she would always invent little canapes, and, you know, with the little ingredients that were out there, my mum kind of, even though we did have simple traditional food, but my mum always kind of, she was a fan of the West, you know, she was a kind of rebellious teenager in the Brezhnev years in the 70s, so she really kind of looked up to the West and kind of, you know, collected as many, you know, cooking magazines as she could that kind of had some references to more kind of contemporary ways of eating. So my mom would always host dinner parties, and then throughout, you know, until now, she still loves doing it. So when I was in my teens, she always had a Friday night gathering with her girlfriends. So it was like a girl kind of evening, and each one would have a theme, and she would kind of design the menu accordingly. So, you know, in a way, it was...
How did you end up doing what you
did? Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, there's a definite connection there.
And in your teens, you then came to England at 15 to go to boarding school. Tell us about boarding school food.
Oh, gosh. I remember the first dinner. My parents actually brought me over here, and you know, they took me to the school, and then it was time for them to leave in the evening. It was a Sunday evening, so they're like, well, let me, you know, let us take you to the canteen and then we'll head back. And obviously, just, you know, being 15 and in a new country, in a new place, it was a bit sad and just really uncomfortable. And then seeing the food, I mean, I then realized that Saturday nights were not the kind of times when the chefs would pull out their, you know, best dishes. So there was like, I think there was like a pizza and chips and fish fingers, that kind of, so just lots of fried stuff and ketchup. And I was a bit like, oh god, I really don't feel like eating that kind of stuff. But, and at first, yeah, I think just getting used to different dishes, like, you know, especially like with crazy names like Spotted Dick and all of that, I was just like, what are they eating? It just sounds obscene and looks quite weird as well. But having lived here for 20 years now, it's actually kind of part of my kind of culinary DNA as well. I feel completely at ease and almost think that's kind of part of, you know, my food as well. So,
and it was an international school.
It was,
that you were
attending.
Were you able to learn from other students, or was everything based on school dinners?
No, actually my school was really amazing in the way they promoted kind of cultural dialogue, and each year we had a cultural festival where girls, you know, from the same country gathered together, and they would cook a meal, and we had like a big kind of buffet dinner where you get to try Nigerian food, Chinese food, all sorts of food. So it was really amazing that I got to taste things that I would have, even back then, you know, 20 years ago, food in England wasn't as kind of diverse as it is now. So it was quite nice to get the chance to taste that kind of food from people who are, you know, originally from that
country. Has that influenced your cooking style?
I think it encouraged me to cook more, because we, aside from the cultural festival that we had in school, we also had a kind of shared kitchen where girls could cook themselves, and just seeing different girls cooking, you know, cooking different meals for dinner and just kind of talking about what, you know, really interesting ingredients that they had. And it definitely encouraged me to cook more and just kind of opened up my kind of culinary awareness a bit. Yeah.
After school, you then went to university where you gained a PhD in film. How has that influenced how you see food?
Well, my PhD was in a subject that's kind of as far from food as possible. It was about the Holocaust. It was quite a tough kind of time doing that, both, you know, intellectually, just doing a PhD is quite tough anyway. Plus the subject was very, you know, emotionally quite hard to deal with. But at the same time, I think that kind of moment was when I really got into cooking and I found this kind of creative and emotional outlet. So in a way, if I haven't done, I sometimes wonder if I haven't done the PhD, maybe I wouldn't have kind of found that love of cooking and kind of seen food as a real kind of medium for, almost like a meditative kind of medium. So that's been quite an interesting and important time in my life, even though I haven't pursued the academic career at all. But it also gave me the idea for my supper club. At that time, I didn't have a kind of particular interest in film specifically that deal with food. It was just more kind of marrying the two strands of my passions and kind of marrying my professional life with my passion really for food. But yeah, that was kind of the beginning of my career U-turn when I really felt like I should stop doing stuff, because it kind of felt like I've always done stuff because I have to, or, you know, I'm expected to do certain things, but finally kind of felt like I should just follow my passion and see what happens.
So tell us about Kino Vino, your supper club.
So I've started Kino Vino 4 years ago now, and the idea for it came quite easily, really. It was almost as a joke. I was on a holiday in Cape Town, where my partner is from, and we did lots of wine tasting there. And, you know, there was a lot of kind of talking about the wine and discussing the bouquet and all of that stuff, which I love as well. And I just kind of, after a few glasses, I was like, well, it'll be quite fun to come up with this dining experience where you kind of pair wine with film and you kind of think what kind of red wine would go with a Fellini film or a Bergman film. And my partner was like, well, why don't you, you know, you're good at organizing things, why don't you do something like that?
So you did.
And I did. And actually, I should say also that while I was doing my PhD, or kind of before that, I worked with film festivals as a curator and kind of project manager for film festivals. So I did have all the practical skills for putting on a film screening. So to me, it was quite easy just to kind of, you know, how would you start? I knew pretty well how to do that. It was more the kind of the food side to me that was a new challenge.
And what was the first film that
you used? First film was Peter Greenaway's The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, which was a really kind of controversial choice considering the ending of the film. I'm not going to spoil it in case people want to watch it and get shocked themselves. But yeah, it was quite as simple, because for that one, I cooked myself with a bunch of friends. I haven't developed the idea of kind of having a famous chef attached to each evening at that point. So it was just me and a bunch of friends gathering and creating kind of a simple roast, Sunday roast style meal, and then having lots of red wine, because, you know, in the film, the color red is so prevalent and it has like quite a, you know, obviously kind of carnivore, blood, flesh. It's a very kind of sexual film. So yeah, it was lots of red wine, lots of meat, that kind of stuff. But then for my second event, it just coincided with a good friend of mine who we studied together with, Orly Hercules. She also was changing her career into food, and she's just published her first cookbook, Mamushka. And she, I remember just chatting to her, and it was also at the same time when the whole kind of horrendous Ukraine-Russia stuff was happening. And she was saying she'd love to do a lot, you know, a lot more with food to kind of promote positive image and so on. So I thought, well, why don't I invite her to be my guest chef for the next Kino Vino? And obviously, once I've had Olya attached to the project, it kind of immediately went up a whole level, and we had press at the event, and it kind of became like a proper professional, you know, dining experience. And well, I think it was then when I thought, maybe actually I can take it a bit further than just kind of having it as a hobby and cooking with friends, but actually reach out to chefs and invite, you know, interesting people to cook with me or cook the meals, and I would curate the dinner. And since then, I've been really lucky to have worked with some of the most amazing chefs in the country, and even, I wouldn't say in the world, but I've had some international chefs as well. And it's been such a fantastic kind of cooking school for me, because I've never had the money or the time to go and actually train as a chef. But running Kino Vino was my way of kind of entering into this world, and not into this world in general, into the world of food, I mean, and learning how to cook and host and, yeah, kind of cook professionally, really.
And are there any particular supper clubs that stand out, you know, particularly great film that's gone so well with the food?
Yeah, well, there were a few. One of them was an Indian-themed night that I've done with Romy Gill, and I was a bit stuck for the film that I wanted to choose. And it was kind of a last minute, I suddenly remembered this really beautiful film called A Lunchbox. And it is the most, just as a film itself, is the most touching, beautifully shot, wonderfully acted, really moving love story, friendship story that forms over food. And it's, you know, and the food in the film plays such an important part. So I saw audiences kind of move to tears at the end of it. And, you know, the food there is described so lusciously, and, you know, the woman cooks all the time. So people were really hungry to, you know, to try the food. So it was a perfect pairing in that sense. And the other film that I really love, it's a very little known documentary called Oma and Bella. And in a way, it's quite similar, I guess, to my own kind of childhood and my own grandmother. The film was shot by this young film director, Alexa Karolinsky, about her Jewish granny who survived the Holocaust. And it's her granny and the granny's friend who cook together, and they make the most simple kind of staple Ashkenazi dishes. And it's pretty much just kind of simple home camera, you know, filming them in the kitchen, but their humor and their love of life and food is just amazing. And we had a really beautiful kind of Eastern European Jewish dinner after that, which went down so well with our guests, and we had like a super sold out night. So that was really, it almost felt like kind of my personal, even though it wasn't my personal story, but it felt so close that it felt like I've shared something of my own as well.
So tell us how you went from curating the meals and hosting to being in the kitchen on a professional side. How did that come about?
Well, I've been running Kinovino, I think, for a year or so, or maybe a bit more, 2 years. And I was still doing a full-time job working with film festivals and teaching. And I felt like I just can't do both. And I felt so drawn and so happy doing Kinovino stuff that I just thought, okay, I'm just going to leave my job and start cooking, like get a job as a chef somewhere and just start cooking. So I worked as a part-time chef in different kind of cafes. I wasn't experienced enough or kind of brave enough to actually go for a proper restaurant job, but it still gave me a lot of experience in cooking and, you know, service and all of that. And obviously working with the Kinovino chefs was incredible. And then gradually I started just developing my own ideas, and the idea of a cookbook started kind of looming around. And there were quite a few factors that came into play that kind of encouraged me to pursue the idea with a cookbook. Shall I talk about that? Or?
Well, I was going to say, was it always going to be a Siberian cookbook? Was that always the plan?
No, actually, initially, my first idea was to do a Kinovino cookbook. But again, it kind of felt, you know, would I be just the editor and getting other people's recipe in it? You know, we would be kind of recreating the meals that we've already had as supper clubs, but into kind of recipe format, adding my tips on styling, table styling and hosting. Then, yeah, it kind of felt like it wouldn't really be mine.
Yeah.
As much as I wanted to express myself, it kind of felt like it wouldn't really give me that opportunity. So one of the things that really kind of prompted the whole Siberian-Russian theme was a charity dinner that, again, Romy Gill organized in Bristol. It was called Seven Sisters. It was the first out of the many that we've done since. And she invited me. There was I can't remember the exact number, but I think there were 10 female chefs who came together to cook for charity. And she invited me along. And at first I thought I would just be helping organize, kind of using my Kinovino skills as a curator and kind of project manager, but it turns out she actually wanted me to cook as well. And kind of having my name up there with all the other chefs, I was really terrified. I mean, honored, happy, but absolutely petrified. And she said, well, why don't you prepare something that's representative of, you know, your own food and the food that you grew up eating? And that was the first time I cooked something Russian for paying customers. And I did a mushroom pickle, like a little mushroom pickle relish salad that was served alongside Romy's curry. And it was kind of, marrying Indian and Siberian cuisine, which was quite fun. It was quite a nice combination and it went down really well. So I started doing a few more little supper clubs. A friend of mine had a cafe in Brighton. So I did a little Russian supper club there, which went really well. And kind of the more I started thinking about it, you know, I had so many personal stories that I wanted to tell through food. I was developing lots of interesting recipes that kind of drew on my Russian Siberian heritage, but added my experience of working in London as a chef and working with chefs in London. And then, you know, there was nothing interesting out there that represented the Russian food that I felt needed to be represented. Mm. You know, there's either the cliches of, I have no idea who publishes those books, but I've recently, the food stylist for the book, Tamara Voss, she recently found this charity shop book. It's called like something like Russian cuisine, and it literally has a Russian church, a bear, a woman with like Horovai cake, like literally every single cliche you could possibly think of. It's on the cover. And that's kind of the stuff that people see when they, you know, when they look for a Russian cookbook, even on Amazon, it's obscene. So I thought, well, there really is need for a really fresh, contemporary cookbook that would be just interesting for anyone, not, you know, not someone who's specializing in Russian history, you know, because it feels like such a niche thing.
Your book, you look back to Soviet era food and also pre-revolutionary food. I mean, what have you discovered about how it's changed?
It's been really interesting. There is a tendency to, especially these days in Russia, there's a tendency to kind of erase the Soviet era and see the Soviet food as this horrendous thing that happened, and, you know, it's really not interesting culinary or from nutrition point of view. But actually, like, having read and looked into recipes, you know, it's a lot more interesting than people perceive it to be. And just because it is, you know, part of a very complicated, quite horrendous regime, you know, there's no need to attach that stigma to the food as well. To me, the main interesting thing was that change from pre-revolutionary to Soviet food is how, you know, the food became a lot more uniform and accessible to people. I have a cookbook from the pre-revolutionary days, which is written in the old Russian, so I couldn't really understand everything. But it's very interesting how the food there is categorized by class. So people of, you know, lower classes would have this kind of a diet, and then people of the upper classes have these kind of recipes. So it was so hierarchical, and you know, there was so much divide and lots of really expensive, very fiddly, very complicated kind of ingredients that went into the food of the noble classes, and then very simple kind of staples that the poorer people had. And I was just very interested to actually see a cookbook that would divide, you know, the kind of guiding principle is class rather than, I don't know, seasons or something. You're kind of a bit more new. Ingredients, exactly. So obviously the Soviet time that did away with class and the food became a lot more accessible. It did get a lot more simplified, but I don't think that simplifying is necessarily always a bad thing. And yes, the ingredients were probably a lot cheaper, but, you know, to feed a huge new nation and to kind of cultivate that sense of national identity through food, the Soviet government had to kind of create this new rules and new diet, really. And it's just, as a kind of, as a social experiment, it's fascinating how a bunch of people gets together and thinks, well, how do we create this new sense of identity in this huge multicultural, multi-religious nation through food? And they literally sat down and started writing recipes. And, you know, it's really fascinating just from a kind of, you know, anyone who's interested in food and history, it's such a fascinating kind of phenomenon, really. Mm.
There are a lot of misconceptions around Russian food, even modern Russian food.
Absolutely.
Which misconceptions were you particularly trying to counteract in Salt and Thyme?
Well, the main thing that I found really fascinating is that when I told people that I am from Russia or am writing a book about Russian food, cabbage was the first thing that came to many people's minds. But actually, when I talked to my Russian friends, even my parents recently, cabbage is something that you don't really think about as being kind of this quintessential Russian ingredient.
It's not a big deal.
It's not a big deal at all, no. I mean, there is kraut, obviously, that's quite a big deal, but, you know, there's other things as well. So I think that kind of the cabbage myth was quite funny. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, it's a negative thing that cabbage is smelly and it makes you, you know, bloated and it's so bad for you. But I actually have some really delicious recipes in the book that use cabbage, and one of my favorite recipes is this cabbage pie, which
I've
is great.
I've heard so much about this cabbage pie. Everyone who's cooked from the book has said to me, oh my God, the cabbage pie. I'm going to have to make it this weekend. I'm so excited.
Oh, that's brilliant.
What's it like, the cabbage pie?
And the cabbage pie is initially the idea for it came from a traditional Eastern European cabbage leaf wrap called golubtsi. It's Ukrainian, Polish, they have like different names in different countries, but it's kind of like little pigeons. And it's rice and mince and mushrooms and then you wrap it in a cab, like a boiled cabbage leaf. It's almost like a dolma, but I think it obviously has some kind of roots to dolmas, but using cabbage, and then it's cooked in a tomato sauce, like poached in a tomato sauce with, and then you add sour cream. But instead of, it's quite fiddly that you have to do lots of rolling of the things, but I just kind of used the same ingredients and made a layered pie where you don't have any pastry. The cabbage leaves encase the filling. Right. And then you bake it and the leaves have this most beautiful pattern and just like visually it looks so pretty. And then in my book, I suggest to serve it with sour cream, but also to make a crumb with pancetta and rye bread and garlic. So it has a bit of kind of crunch to it as well. So to me, kind of the visual aspect of the food is really important. And I guess one of the negative stereotypes that Russian food does have is it's quite ugly and stodgy and there's lots of mayo. And, you know, partly true. I mean, obviously stereotypes do have some kind of root in the reality and the truth. So to me, yeah, the aesthetic was really important. So I kind of pared it down and made it a bit lighter and more contemporary and kind of more minimalist, I guess. Or, yeah, just kind of looking at ingredients and thinking, well, which one of them tastes good but also looks good and how do I bring it out in the dish? Yeah.
And the title, Salt and Thyme, is a reference to the fermentation and the importance of that.
It is. It began as that. I did a few pop-ups before the, almost like kind of a recipe testing exercise. I did a few pop-ups with the recipes from the book, calling it Salt and Thyme, because I think it was about 2 years ago when I felt like the whole kind of craze for fermented stuff was really going strong in London, and all, you know, the vegan eating and the kombuchas and the crowds.
Gut health.
Gut health. Oh my God, yes. But, you know, to me, it was the most standard, as we've said before, you know, it was just the thing you did because you didn't have any other food and you had to have that. Otherwise, you know, there'll be nothing. And the health benefits were not really the main thing that people thought about when they made crowds. So I thought it would be quite interesting to kind of draw this parallel between something super trendy in London to my childhood, to the Soviet era, or even, you know, fermenting is such a huge part of Russian cuisine. It kind of dates back to the Middle Ages. So it was a very interesting parallel to create. So I started doing those supper clubs, calling them Salt and Thyme, because there was a fermented element in every dish. And then when I was thinking of the title for the book, that was my working title and for the proposal. And then the more I thought about it, obviously the book is a lot about, you know, kind of me having this distance from my home. And obviously time is such a fascinating phenomenon, you know, Proustian sense and all that. Time is a huge, obviously, element in cooking, and so is salt. So it started off as a very specific culinary term, but then it does have like really beautiful kind of poetic connotations, and visually as well, salt and snow have a similarity. So yeah, there were lots of really beautiful things kind of floating about.
And then speaking of time, I suppose you've been over here for 20 years.
Yeah.
And what's changed, do you think, most dramatically in Siberian cuisine?
Well, obviously the fall of the Soviet Union and the trade with the West, especially. There's a lot of Western influences in the food now. It was interesting. I have a recipe in the book, which is a buckwheat risotto. And there was recently a post online about it. And someone from Russia commented saying, oh, well, we never ate risotto in Siberia. This is so inauthentic. And I'm so tired of chefs trying to kind of pretend, you know, kind of change the food and make it more complicated. You know, what's wrong with just buckwheat porridge, which essentially that was the dish that inspired it. Obviously, you're not just going to enter buckwheat porridge as a recipe into a book, just saying, you know, boil the porridge, done. But also, actually, there is a term grechoto in Russian now, which is like grechka is the word for buckwheat, and obviously otto thing is like risotto. So, well, I said, well, actually, there is a term like that, and it's interesting to see how the Russian kind of culinary tradition is getting inspired by the Western traditions and how it keeps evolving. So it's only, I mean, I'm all up for that, to see how a very old, almost ancient recipe gets kind of re-zhuzhed into something a bit more contemporary and using influences from Italian cuisine in this particular case. But now it's actually, with the recent sanctions, it's very interesting to see how kind of local food produce is working, because all the kind of, again, Italian cheeses, for example, they are banned in Russia now. So farmers are starting to produce their own ricotta and burrata and all of that, which I haven't actually tried it. Lots of people say it's delicious, but obviously a lot more expensive. Might probably not be as good because there's not enough kind of years of practice of making it. But it's, yeah, it's fascinating to see how, you know, for me, politics and food and kind of culture and food was so interlinked. And it's fascinating to see how kind of political events influence how the food is developing in Russia, for example. But
Alyssa, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about your experiences through food. Salt and Thyme is published by Octopus and is available online and in all good bookstores now. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please rate, review and subscribe online to help people find the podcast. Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.